Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, an innovative approach to providing health care being tested right here in Fresno, and how criminal defense attorneys feel about propositions to revise the three strikes law and eliminate the death penalty. Plus, Fresno County voters are being asked to support a measure that could result in the outsourcing of county services, and celebrating the pomegranate. But first, an innovative new project that brings together the worlds of high finance and healthcare has chosen Fresno as the first community in the nation to embrace a new approach to preventative medicine. Valley Public Radio's Joe Moore has this report.
When Benjamin Franklin wrote that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, he had no idea he'd be describing one of 2012's hottest trends in healthcare and investments, something known as social impact bonds. The details are complex, but the concept is based around a simple idea.
What we're really trying to do is demonstrate that there's a business case for prevention.
That's Rick Brush, founder and CEO of Collective Health, a company that has selected Fresno's Clinica Sierra Vista to launch the first social impact bond in the country to focus on healthcare. And here in the Central Valley, their efforts at prevention are focused on one of the area's biggest health concerns, asthma.
We look across what's driving healthcare costs in any particular area, and in Fresno we know that asthma is a significant issue. So we look at opportunities to prevent the most severe cases of asthma and asthma emergencies.
Brush says the idea is to attract money from investors to pay for upfront treatments, in this case relatively small steps that can reduce indoor air pollution for those suffering with asthma. Health providers save money with reduced costs, and they share those savings with the investors.
If we keep it simple and focus on bringing money to the table where we can really make a difference in communities and also at the same time generate a financial return for those investors who are essentially giving us a loan to make those improvements in communities, I think that we'll be able to demonstrate something really powerful.
While this is the first time that a social impact bond has been focused on healthcare, similar projects have recently launched in other fields. In 2010, a social impact bond in the United Kingdom debuted with a goal of reducing the number of ex-prisoners who wind up back behind bars.
In the United States, really, this is just starting to gain momentum. New York City was the first to announce a program using a social impact bond, and that also was for prisoner recidivism. And the state of Massachusetts is launching a couple of social impact bonds, one for prisoner recidivism and the other for reductions in homelessness.
The New York City project was led by a nearly $10 million investment from the Wall Street firm Goldman Sachs over 4 years. If the project is successful at keeping teen offenders from returning to jail, Goldman Sachs stands to profit from the money the city would otherwise spend on incarceration. If it fails, the company could lose millions. Back in Fresno, Kevin Hamilton, deputy chief of programs for Clinica Sierra Vista, says he was initially skeptical about the project.
Trust me, when I first heard about this, which was about 8 months ago, 10 months ago, I was a skeptic.
But he says he soon saw the potential, not only for investors to profit, but also for savings to be invested back into more preventative programs.
If the health insurance companies agree that this money that they save is money that they can then use to reinvest, to repeat the process along the way, this could be very powerful.
Hamilton says his group was chosen for this project in part because of his research into the effectiveness of in-home interventions in preventing asthma attacks caused by indoor air pollution. Other project partners include UCSF and the Central California Asthma Coalition. According to numbers provided by Collective Health, the project plans to conduct interventions for 1,100 Fresno children who have been diagnosed with asthma. Together, they account for $17 million in health care costs for emergency room visits, hospitalizations, and follow-ups. With an initial investment of $1.1 million, the project has set a goal of reducing total costs by as much as $6 million. The savings to insurance companies and Medi-Cal will allow the investors to be repaid with 5% interest, and the rest of the savings can be reinvested into patient care. So what types of interventions can create such a dramatic cost savings? It turns out to be things that many of us take for granted, like making sure kids get regular checkups at the doctor and clean carpets.
We'll also be doing an in-home assessment to determine what kind of housing they live in. Are there problems in the house, like old carpets that are full of dust? Is there a mold problem? Asthma-safe cleaning solvents and things like that. Are the families using that? Do they have access to those kinds of things? Do they have a vacuum cleaner with a HEPA filter? All those sorts of things will be assessed. And wherever there are things that could be corrected, this project will be supplying us with money to do that. We have approximately $1,000 to spend on each household.
That means if a family has dust-filled, moldy carpet, Hamilton's crew will help replace it and work to fix the source of the problem, or purchase a new vacuum cleaner. According to Hamilton, everything from indoor air filters to pest removal and weatherizing windows can have a big impact on indoor air quality and asthma attacks.
You're talking about reducing costs around this chronic illness by about one-third. So if you can put one-sixth of the money in and get a reduction of cost of one-third, and the money that you put in, you only put in year one, and in year two, you're not spending any extra money, then you continue to realize that profit, if you will, over time. It's got a long-term impact.
John Kapitman, executive director of the Central Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State, says that while the idea behind this project's financing may be new, it's especially well-suited for treating a chronic disease such as asthma.
This is one of the areas where we've got the best potential to make this idea work. Here in Fresno, we have a high proportion of people with badly managed asthma, who have asthma. It's severe, but they're just not succeeding in keeping it well under control, either because of their environment or their access to care or because of things that are just beyond their control, such as air quality. And this plan brings to people's homes all kinds of help to improve the environment of their home and to help them learn new skills and new access to health care to hopefully improve their outcomes. And the potential exists to reduce costs of asthma care for these kinds of folks by a tremendous amount.
Still, for other diseases, Kapitman remains somewhat skeptical of the potential behind social impact bonds.
I think that for many health issues, the changes that people need to make in their lives and their environments are probably more expensive than that, or have longer returns on investment than may be acceptable to social impact bond investors. So I guess all that adds up to, I think there are probably a limited number of health issues that this might work with.
The uncertainty around the future of the social impact bond model in the healthcare system is part of the reason for the Fresno program. Rick Brush and Collective Health will use the project to gather data and hopefully attract future investors. Until now, most of the investors in such projects have been philanthropic foundations, but Brush also sees the potential with institutional investors and beyond.
We also think that high net worth individuals, especially those who favor social impact in the investments they make, will be very interested in this.
If all goes well, the Fresno project hopes to get underway early next year. The California Endowment has been funding the early planning stages of the operation, and Brush and Hamilton hope to receive a significant investment from the endowment that would launch the project. Brush also says that as social impact bonds catch on nationwide, some laws may need to be changed to allow governments to participate in the program and pass along general fund savings to investors. But while the results of this first-of-its-kind investment in prevention are still a couple of years away, right now the promise of bringing investors and health providers together remains very appealing.
If the idea works, I think people will jump on it. And I think the idea of seeking ways for private investors to make money and add to the solving of social problems is very exciting.
For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
With the week to go before the election, we continue our look at the propositions. You may recall that last week on Valley Edition, retired 5th District Court of Appeals Justice Judge James Ardaiz spoke out against Propositions 34 and 36. Proposition 34 would eliminate the death penalty in California and replace it with life in prison without the possibility of parole. And Proposition 36, which would revise the three strikes law. Joining us today is Garrick Byers, a criminal defense attorney. Thank you, Mr. Byers, for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you know, as you very well know, I'm sure you've read it, Proposition 36 revises the three strikes law to impose life sentences only when a new felony conviction is serious or violent. And it would authorize the resentencing for offenders currently serving life sentences. So if there is a third strike, if that third strike was not serious or violent, so if this proposition passes, there would be the possibility of people who are already serving time, they who are currently locked up, could be released because they've served their time.
It would be possible for some. It would not be for all. The resentencing provision only would apply to those who would have qualified for a second strike sentence had that law been in effect at the time they were originally sentenced. And not all of those, they don't get an automatic resentence. First of all, they have to petition, but more importantly, the court is required to take public safety into account in deciding whether to resentence. They can look at their record in prison. If they've had disciplinary actions in prison, they're less likely to get a resentence. They can look at other circumstances. So only some of them will be resentenced. And more important, the fast way of stating this proposition, that if the third strike is not, the third felony is not serious or violent, they would get a second strike sentence. That's not completely true. This is actually a more modest proposition because if the prior convictions, the prior serious or violent felony convictions were among the most serious ones, child molestation, rape, murder, if they were among the most, or heavy drug trafficking, if they were among the most serious ones, then even a non-serious or violent third felony would get a third strike life term. So it's a very limited initiative or proposition.
Now, many public defenders, I've even read some district attorneys, support revising proposition. What is their main reasons for that?
The main reason is that it's oftentimes unfair and obviously unfair to sentence a person who has committed a third felony that, as felonies go, may be relatively minor, such as a petty theft by a person who has a prior theft conviction. It's unfair, sometimes obviously unfair, to sentence such people to life in prison. That's the main reason. There's also an economic reason because it costs money to keep such people who are no longer any risk in prison for life. So there's a lot of reasons.
Well, you know, now those who support three strikes might say that if someone has been convicted of two serious crimes or a violent offense, if you let them out of prison, they're just going to commit another crime. And in many cases, we've seen that locally with the realignment and jail overcrowding. Many of those who are let out do commit are committing crimes again. So those who support three strikes would argue that if you let some of those out of prison, they're just going to commit another crime, serious or not.
There's two questions involved there. One is, before they get out, is it fair to send a person to prison for life for a relatively minor third felony? That's one question. Another question is, when a person's crime record is decreasing and they are getting older because they don't get younger, They're getting older. Older people tend to commit fewer crimes when their crime and their crime record is documented to be decreasing. It's still a crime record, but it is decreasing. They're less and less likely. The money that's saved can go to other kinds of deterrence, can go to other methods of deterring and preventing crime other than locking people up, which simply locking them up has been shown by our history not to be that effective. And there's other methods that should be used.
Now, some have estimated that the state would save maybe over $100 million a year if Proposition 36 is revised. And you're saying what they could do is take that money and put it into preventative programs.
That money can be used for a lot of such uses. It can be used for education. Both you get to people when they're young, when they're still in school, that's the main time to get to them. It can be used for drug rehabilitation because many criminals are criminals because they're addicted to drugs. It can be used for drug rehabilitation. It can be used for alcohol rehabilitation. There's a lot of alcoholics who commit crimes. And that is likely to be more effective. That in itself is also likely to reduce crime rate and reduce recidivism rate.
Now, voters passed the three strikes law in 1994. Again, there was an attempt to change it in 2004. But couldn't you argue that this is just what the people want?
That was the case when it was first passed. Times may have changed. I believe the times have changed. As we have gotten experience with this law, I think that we have seen that while there is still something to be said for blocking up people who are still committing serious and violent felonies for life, I think people are coming to realize that there's less to be said in favor of locking up the less serious ones for life.
And we have read about, and I think is this part of the reason why they want to revise this? We have read about people who, I just read about one case, it was a few years ago in Bakersfield where a man got three strikes for stealing a donut. We've heard about other kind of petty crimes. How prevalent is that?
These do happen. One of the things in Fresno in particular is that the prosecutors strictly abide by the requirement to charge all of the prior strikes. So even if it's a relatively minor crime, that will be charged as a third strike case. So they do arise. I've handled a handful of those myself over the years.
Another point that has been made with this particular law is that it did show, especially after the first few years after Proposition 36 was passed, that the crime in the state did go down.
Crime in the state went down. Crime all over the country went down. It's very difficult to say for sure what the causes of these were. But since crime all over the country went down, it's unlikely that California's law is what caused crime all over the country go down. It's unlikely, I think, that it caused crime in California to go down. I'm a criminal defense lawyer. I get a fair number of these cases. And while I find that my clients are scared of this, they don't want these strikes, I've never had somebody say to me, oh, I didn't do this because I was afraid of the strike law. People don't like it. Once they're charged, they're frightened of it. But it doesn't seem to deter.
At the time when they're committing a crime, they're not thinking about, oh, if I commit that third strike, this is what happened. That's what you're saying.
People, no. I've had one or two people have told me that. They said, I didn't do this crime, and you know I didn't do this crime because I wouldn't commit a strike. But that's fairly rare for somebody to tell me that.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about Proposition 34, which will eliminate the death penalty and replace it with life in prison without the possibility of parole. Many attorneys support this piece of proposed legislation. Why do you think that is?
I think that it's for the reason that it's put forward, which is economics and futility. The death penalty, the death row population has grown over the last 30 years by leaps and bounds. It's now 726 by the prison system's last official count on October 5. The California Supreme Court has only ruled on 284 of those by the last official count. There's more people being added than these sentences are being affirmed. These cases are getting older and older. Death penalty litigation in California, if you step back and look at it objectively, death penalty litigation is not about the death penalty. It's about which prison the person is going to spend the rest of his or her natural life in. There's been 84 people in the last 30 years on death row die of natural causes or suicide, one or two murders, but not the execution. There's been 13 by execution, and the population has grown and grown. So in California, that litigation isn't about execution, really. It's really about where they're going to spend the rest of their life, this prison or that prison.
Well, you know, when we do have a lot of people on death row, and if people and we continue to sentence people to death, so would it not be fair to say that people feel like that penalty is warranted in some cases? And then on the other hand, what do you say to those, you know, crime victims and their loved ones? You know, they may feel that they want that particular form of justice carried out.
There certainly are some who do want it carried out. There's some who don't also. Even among those who do want it carried out, many of them want closure more than they want anything else. And for many of those people, these appeals and so forth that drag on for 10 years, 20 years, repeatedly bring up the pain, bring up the hurt. That's not true for everybody. It's true for many. In addition to considering the direct victims, the next of kin, it is also necessary to consider the wider society and their views also.
You know, much has been said that the problem is it's just the whole process and the system is kind of broken. Could that be fixed?
I think that if it could be fixed, it would have been done by now.
So it's many people say, and that's why they're looking at this, and you have many law enforcement who are supporting it, that really they just think it's a broken system that can't be fixed.
I don't think California system can be fixed. I note in the ballot pamphlet that we all get in the mail, the opposition to this proposition doesn't propose a fix. They oppose, they want to keep the death penalty on the books, but they don't propose how to fix it. As I said, I think if it could be fixed, I think it would have been done by now.
Okay. Thank you. Garrick Byers, criminal defense attorney here in Fresno, thank you so much for your comments on this particular issue. People will be going to the polls next week to report or to vote on those issues.
Thank you very much.
And we are going to continue our reports on some of the propositions. When California voters go to the polls on Election Day, they could usher in a change that hasn't happened since 1965. They could give one party a two-thirds supermajority in the state Senate. Democrats are campaigning hard to make that happen. But as Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, Republicans are fighting just as hard to prevent it.
And with your help, I'm looking forward to serving in the state Senate. Thank you.
When Democratic Assemblymember Kathleen Galgiani kicked off her campaign for state Senate last month in Stockton, the Senate's top Democrat stood right beside her.
We must elect Kathleen Galgiani. We have an opportunity in the Senate to get to a two-thirds supermajority.
Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg has been traveling up and down the state pushing that message. Democrats hold 25 Senate seats. Only two more would give them a supermajority.
Obviously, my main responsibility is to raise the resources and raise the money for the Senate campaigns. and that's what I'm spending a lot of time doing. And we're just going to go, you know, full pedal to the metal between now and Election Day in November.
Senate District 5, which pits Galjani against Republican Assemblymember Bill Berryhill, is one of three key districts that Democrats are targeting. Winning one of the three will get them a supermajority. Republicans have always been concerned about the potential for that, but this year redistricting created more swing areas.
I mean, that's been the issue all year. Can we hold the line?
Republican Senate Minority Leader Bob Huff.
Now, the Democrats, it's a holy grail for them because they can raise taxes, they can override vetoes. There's a lot of little things they can do if they hit that supermajority.
Democrats aren't expected to reach a supermajority in the Assembly, but Huff says it's easier for Democrats to get the critical votes they need in that chamber. So Republicans are playing to voters' fears of what a Senate supermajority would mean.
In just about every poll we do, the people, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, are very concerned that any single party can raise taxes without going back to vote of the people. So that's a strong message that just resonates.
Democrats are also targeting Senate District 27, which includes parts of Los Angeles, the San Fernando Valley, and Ventura County. There, Republican newcomer Todd Zink is running against incumbent Senator Fran Pavley.
This is a tough race. This is probably the toughest of the three for the Republicans.
Wesley Hussey is an assistant professor of government at Sacramento State University.
This is where I think the Republicans will need to divert a lot of their resources to make sure they can win the seat.
Zink, a former lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, has raised almost $1 million, and TV and radio ads are hitting the airwaves.
Todd Zink, proven leadership to take on the big problems in Sacramento. As a Marine
Corps, no matter how much Republicans spend in District 27, they'll likely be outspent by Democrats. The other closely watched race is Senate District 31 in Riverside County, which pits Democrat Richard Roth against Republican Jeff Miller. Again, Wesley Hussey.
This is a district Republicans have actually done well in registration. In other parts of the state, they're losing registration. Here, they actually gain in the last 6 months. So you can see they put a lot of effort in here, a lot of resources here. They think they can win this one.
An odd dynamic in that race, a Democrat who lost in the primary, former Assemblymember Steve Clute, has endorsed the Republican candidate. His reasoning, according to his endorsement letter, Sacramento politicians have become too involved in local races because they want a supermajority. At the state capitol, I'm Amy Quinton.
But even if California Democrats finally reach a two-thirds supermajority in the state Senate, people from both parties don't think Sacramento's legislative landscape would change that much. And as Ben Adler reports from Sacramento, the biggest impact on next year's atmosphere at the state capitol will likely come from something else entirely.
This story is based on a hypothetical, but not a far-fetched one. Most California political watchers agree that when the next legislature is sworn in later this year, Democrats will likely have a two-thirds supermajority in the state Senate. The question we ask here is, so what? And the answer, even from Democrats, is probably not very much.
Well, if you hear the Republicans talk about it, it'd be the end of civilization because Democrats would do nothing but pass taxes all day and all night long.
Democratic consultant Steve Maviglio.
But I don't think that's the reality.
Now, there are several reasons why that's the case. First, the Assembly. Democrats would need 54 seats to get a supermajority there. Republican strategist Marty Wilson runs the Political Action Committee for the California Chamber of Commerce. He says that possibility is pretty slim.
We believe that the Republicans, you know, probably actually gain a couple of seats in the Assembly.
And even in Speaker John Perez's best case scenario,
we'll build from a base of 50 districts to somewhere between 51 and 53.
In other words, no two-thirds majority for Democrats in the other chamber, so no carte blanche to raise taxes or fees or override a gubernatorial veto. The Senate can only do so much by itself. So Maviglio says Governor Jerry Brown and Democratic legislative leaders will still have to negotiate on at least some parts of their agenda, with moderate Democrats in the Senate and especially moderate Republicans in the Assembly.
I think you will see a lot more deal-making because many measures will boil down to one or two votes.
But will there be any moderates? CalChamber's Marty Wilson says yes.
With the redistricting that was done that's created, you know, very competitive districts, I think you're going to see a much more moderate Assembly, both Republican and Democratic, members.
Of course, moderate is in the eye of the beholder. The chamber is looking for lawmakers from both parties, but particularly Democrats, who will work to reduce state regulations and block bills it labels job killers. Democrats, meanwhile, want Republicans who haven't signed a no-tax pledge. They hoped redistricting, along with California's new top two primary system, would bring moderate Republicans to Sacramento. But Speaker Perez isn't optimistic about that.
I don't see a single Republican district that is a Republican on Republican top two general election where there's a major ideological difference between the Republican candidates.
And that's why analysts from both parties suggest a two-thirds Senate supermajority might not make much of a difference next year by itself. The real factor, they say, will likely be this.
Are we going to win Proposition 30?
That's Senate Leader Daryl Steinberg at a campaign rally for the governor's sales and income tax measure. If Prop 30 passes, Democrats could claim momentum and a mandate for their agenda, though some moderates might feel that's enough new taxes for now. If it fails, says CalChamber's Marty Wilson.
I just think they're going to be very hard-pressed to be looking at these revenue enhancers, and they're just going to have to hunker down into a very austere budget, and God forbid, maybe they'll start thinking, well, what can we do around here to grow the economy?
So on election night, California Democrats won't just be eyeing the number 27, the number of seats for a Senate supermajority. They'll be locked in on the number 30 as well. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
And I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. We'll be right back.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Cahuilla Delta Medical Center and Kaiser Permanente.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Fresno County voters will vote on a measure that could change the way county services are provided. It is Measure O, and it will amend the charter to allow the Fresno County Board of Supervisors, with a three-vote majority, to outsource services currently being done by county workers. Joining us is Supervisor Debbie Puchigian. Supervisor Puchigian, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, you know, supervisors have attempted and they've talked about outsourcing the county's public defender's office. Is this measure aimed at that?
No, it's not aimed at the public defender's office at all. It's aimed at just a variety of opportunities that we might have to save the taxpayers money. No, nothing specific. There are some areas, you know, that the private sector may be able to do a more efficient job. I was not really considering the public defender as one of those areas, but you know, some people have said that that's their concern. But that's not what I was thinking with this. No.
But if I read the measure correctly, this would allow supervisors, without any bargaining to take place, to replace county workers with independent contractors.
Well, when you say without any bargaining, there would be competitive. It'd be transparent. There'd be competitive bidding process. This isn't just something that we would do. We would go through the process if it turned out that it was more efficient and more economical for taxpayers. Then you move to the next step, Juanita. This is not something that we're just going to do because we feel like it. You have to have a competitive bidding process, and it would be an open, fair bidding process. And if the private sector can provide a service for a lot less money and provide the same service more economically, then this measure would allow the supervisors to even consider it.
Okay. So you're saying there would be a process involved in this whole process as far as bringing in an independent contractor?
Oh, absolutely. We do a lot of contracting out now, which we're allowed to do. We do quite a bit now. This would involve a transparent bidding process, yes, and this would allow us to contract out services that may currently be fulfilled by county employees.
But what I meant by bargaining units, and I don't know this for sure, but what I'm trying to get at is would the county with a three-vote majority be able to would you be negotiating with the unions, or would you just be putting the services out for bid?
No, we would not. This is not something that would be negotiated with anyone other than whoever would like to bid on it. And it's not the unions. It would be the county employees. The departments also have the opportunity to bid on the same project. And what we found, you know, we may find that there is substantial savings. We may find that the savings is not substantial enough to move forward. But this gives even departments in the county the opportunity to be involved in a competitive bidding process with maybe someone in the private sector.
Well, you know, there are some, just playing, you know, devil's advocate.
Sure.
Currently, there are some who would say that currently on the board, there are three supervisors, you supervisors, Larson and Case, have been known to vote together on certain issues. So some would say this is basically giving the three of you the authority to make these kinds of changes if all it took was a three-vote majority instead of a four-vote majority.
Come and go. This was established in 1976. We've had a lot of supervisors come and go in that time, last 30, how many years is that, 36 years. So it is not about the current board of supervisors. It's most of the business that we conduct. I would say over 95% of the business that we conduct as supervisors, whoever they are, not specifically us, but whoever the supervisors are, 95% and more is a majority vote. The majority rules, three votes for almost everything that we do. And so we're just saying, you know, this should not be any different. I mean, I'm not going to be there forever. You know, the majority will change. The people will come and go. It's not about individual supervisors and this board. This is something that started 36 years ago. We think it's time to address it again since, you know, times are tough and we're doing everything we can. We're looking for every way to save tax dollars, to help the private sector with the economy. This will create jobs in our economy. And then any savings will be available for public safety and other departments.
So, but still, you're looking at three votes instead of the four votes. And there would be some people who would say, with something this important, you should definitely have, four votes as opposed to the three.
Well, I've only been there 4 years. I've cast thousands and thousands of votes at this point. Most of them, like I say, over 95%, probably 98% of them have been a majority vote. That's how it is. The majority rules whoever it is. I've been on the losing end of a majority vote, and I've been on a winning end of a majority vote. This isn't anything personal with other supervisors at all. But this is an opportunity to save tax dollars. It's a tool that this board or future boards can use to get more out of the tax dollars for, you know, we've got hardworking families giving us tax dollars to spend and to spend wisely. And this just is another tool to be more efficient and save money.
How could this impact county services?
How could it impact county services? Well, as an example, this just came to mind. Let's say we need some type of service in Coalinga. Rather than sending county employees from downtown Fresno to Coalinga to provide the service, which is costly, you got to get cars, you've got to get whatever you're going to send, you know, this would give an opportunity. If it is a service that the private sector can provide, something local in Coalinga, that would be a lot less expensive.
And then,
let me just say this. I'm not aware of any other county that requires a supermajority on these types of issues. I'm not aware of anywhere else that does that. This was something that was put into the charter in 1976. I don't know why. Maybe, it's kind of job protection maybe, but, you know, this really is not anything personal with any groups. It's not anything personal with any supervisors. This is just a way to try to save tax dollars so that we have that available for public safety and other departments.
And we should point out that many other counties have also done this, gone the route of outsourcing or privatizing.
If it's more efficient, it saves money, and it's, you know, economical. that's why we want this tool. If it, all those things happen, and it will be an open bidding process, just like everything else, a competitive bidding process. There's not going to be anything to hide in this.
But I think the bottom line here is that for many who might be in opposition, is that in the end you are talking about jobs, and the county has had to do a lot of awful, terrible cuts, just like the city and other public entities. And it would probably mean that some people might be losing their jobs. And I think that's part of what this comes down to for a lot of folks.
Well, our pension and benefit costs in the county are very, very high. And so for every dollar that we spend, in some areas we're spending over 50 cents for the pension and benefit cost as well. And so, you know, those promises were made before I joined the board. And it's something that it looks like we're not going to be able to afford to continue with that. And so we're just trying to save money any way we can to provide good service to the taxpayers of Fresno County.
Okay. Supervisor Bouchigian, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy morning to talk to us about this Measure O.
Thank you, Juanita. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, next Tuesday, California voters will be asked to weigh in on 11 different ballot measures covering topics ranging from corporate taxes to crime and punishment. Today, we conclude our month-long series of reports on all 11 propositions with a look at two more. Here's Valley Public Radio's Joe Moore.
Proposition 39 would change a critical piece of corporate tax law and provide more money to the state, but higher taxes for some businesses. Marianne Russ has more from Sacramento.
It was called the most boring proposition on the 2012 ballot by a San Diego blogger. The writer has a point. It revolves around a corporate tax formula known as the single sales factor. But when you consider that corporate taxes accounted for nearly $10 billion in California last year, Prop 39 doesn't sound so boring anymore.
In closing this loophole for out-of-state corporations, we get back to something which is fairer.
Hedge fund manager Tom Steyer is leading the charge for Prop 39. Here's what he calls unfair. Right now, multi-state businesses can choose how to figure their California tax liability. They can use a formula based on their sales, payroll, and property in the state, or a formula based solely on their sales in the state, known as the single sales factor. Steyer says this hurts job creation.
We want to take away the incentive for companies from out of state to fire Californians and move their facilities out of state while selling into the largest market in the United States.
Under Prop 39, all companies would have to use the single sales factor. The state's nonpartisan legislative analyst says that would bring in about $1 billion a year for the general fund and for energy efficiency projects. But Dorothy Rothrock with the California Manufacturers and Technology Association says that $1 billion would come with consequences. She says multi-state companies might cut jobs or raise prices if Prop 39 passes.
Companies that would be hurt by single sales factor in California include many manufacturers who have payroll and property here, but they just have so much sales in the state because we're so huge that taxing them on the basis of their sales makes their taxes go sky high.
A mostly Democratic group of state lawmakers pushed legislation this year that was similar to Prop 39, but the measure failed. In Sacramento, I'm Marianne Russ.
We conclude our series on the 11 ballot measures Californians will decide this fall with a look at Proposition 40. Its supporters have abandoned it, but California voters will still weigh in. Marianne Russ has more from Sacramento on the referendum that seeks to overturn the current state Senate district map.
Political consultant Leo McElroy describes Proposition 40 like this.
Probably one of the most extreme misadventures we've seen for the California Republican Party.
Here's the backstory. Voters created the Citizens Redistricting Commission to draw California's political lines. But when the maps came out last year, some Republicans feared they'd lose a couple of seats in the state Senate. So they put Prop 40 on the ballot. It's a referendum that seeks to throw out the current Senate map. But along the way, the state Supreme Court upheld the commission's districts, and the Republicans behind Prop 40 abandoned it, saying that with the court's action, the measure was no longer needed. Now here's where it gets tricky. A yes vote upholds the current maps. A no vote rejects them. McElroy says that's confusing for some people.
You're going to have a bunch of people vote no on this just on general principles, that they vote no on anything they don't understand.
That worries Stan Forbes, who chairs the Citizens Redistricting Commission.
It's very concerning that you've got this long ballot, and people, you know, if they don't know the issue, the default vote is typically no.
Forbes wants people to remember that instead of lawmakers drawing their own lines, the commission held 30 public hearings and considered 20,000 public comments in crafting the districts.
I think that the public should vote yes on this because this is really a culmination of what they created. And to vote against our maps would really be to vote against themselves.
Forbes says even though Prop 40's supporters have abandoned it, it's only fair that voters weigh in, since hundreds of thousands of Californians signed a petition to get the referendum on the ballot. In Sacramento, I'm Marianne Russ.
And I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
As voters go to the polls this year, much has been made of the issue of voter fraud. But in this commentary from Diane Blair, part of our ongoing series The Moral Is, protecting the integrity of elections means much more than just addressing fraud.
Throughout our nation's history, the right to vote has been the number one factor in determining who participates in our democratic process. At the founding of our nation, only white, male property owners were guaranteed the right to vote. Even with the inclusion of constitutional amendments that sought to guarantee African American men and eventually all women the right of suffrage, individual states enacted laws meant to intimidate, humiliate, and ultimately deprive legitimate citizens of their right to political voice. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 outlawed many of these discriminatory practices, like the poll tax and literacy tests. As such, our last presidential election saw a voter turnout rate of 63% and also saw advances toward a voting population in 2008 that more equitably approximated the electorate as a whole. But some believe since that last election, we have entered a new era of voter suppression. According to the nonpartisan Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law, 5 million eligible voters may find it harder to vote in 2012 due to the newly enacted voter restrictions. They also argue that these new restrictions fall unequally on some of the most politically vulnerable among us: young voters, people of color, the elderly, low-income voters, as well as voters with disabilities. Many of the election laws enacted since 2008 have reduced voters' opportunities to register to vote and to take advantage of early voting. Of central concern is a nationwide surge in voter ID laws. According to a recent study by the Brennan Center, 11% of voting-age citizens are without the required state-issued photo ID. Laws that require citizens to show valid identification cards at the polls present a real challenge for some voters. Although states that require IDs to vote say they will provide free ID cards to those without driver's licenses, travel to the appropriate office to get cards can be inconvenient and difficult for those without cars or access to public transportation. This is especially true for people who live in rural areas. In addition, the documentation required to get the ID cards can be costly. Proponents of these new restrictions to voting argue that they are necessary to crack down on election fraud. Certainly, we want to ensure the integrity and legitimacy of our election process. But just how rampant is this fraud in the nation? Between 2000 and 2010, 649 million votes were cast in general elections. During that same time period, only 13 credible cases of in-person voter fraud were identified. Several of these new voting restrictions have been challenged in a court of law. Some have been upheld, others have been reversed or weakened, and others are still in legal limbo. The flurry of laws and subsequent legal decisions in response to these laws may create significant confusions not only among voters but also poll workers this year. Election Protection, a nonpartisan coalition comprised of more than 100 local, state, and national partners, seeks to ensure that all voters have an equal opportunity to participate in the political process. Their website provides up-to-date comprehensive voter information and advice on how to make sure your vote is counted. You can also call their hotline at 1-866-OUR-VOTE. As November 6th approaches, we should take care to learn the laws of our state and to know our rights as citizens. That knowledge, more so than any election restriction, will ensure the integrity and well-being of our democracy. For The Moral Is, this is Diane Blair.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
This fall, residents of the San Joaquin Valley have an important choice. No, not the election. I'm talking about Valley Public Radio's October membership campaign. Public radio relies on your support to keep great programs like this one on the air. Your annual membership donation is your vote for quality news, music, and entertainment programming each and every day of the year. Join today. Call 800-275-0764 or visit kvpr.org.
Welcome back. I'm Anita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Well, Madera County is gaining reputation as the heart of pomegranate country, and Madera has begun a week-long celebration that is now being used in celebrating the pomegranate, which is now being used just about everything. Here to tell us more about the event is Casey Pomering. Casey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Juanita. I appreciate it.
Well, just how big is the pomegranate crop in Madera County?
You know, there is more acreage going in every year. So the last statistics we have are from 2010. So I can't even give you a great good number on how many pomegranates are being grown in Madera County. The reason that Madera is the heart of pomegranate country is because they're grown all throughout Central California, but the bulk of them are grown in our area, and also many of those pomegranates come to Madera for processing.
And why do you think it's become so popular? You know, people use it in just about everything.
Well, you know, Juanita, I think people are getting a little more educated about what they're eating and making choices in terms of superfruits and superfoods and trying to eat healthy, but also everyone loves something tasty and flavorful. And so the pomegranate, with all its heart-healthy qualities, but also, you know, the great taste and flavor, that tanginess, I think that's why pomegranate is catching on.
So how have you chosen to celebrate it? Now, this is your second annual festival. So what are some of the things that are going to be taking place?
Well, this is Celebration Week, so there are pomegranate dinners at the Vineyard Restaurant and at Fleming's in Fresno. There's a softball tournament, there's a golf tournament, all kinds of pomegranate-themed events. And then the festival itself is Saturday from 10 to 4 at the Madera Municipal Airport. You can use our pomegranate launcher. You can taste all kinds of pomegranate foods. There's a huge kids zone. There's live music by Deja Blues. And I don't know if you saw our pomegranate rock video on YouTube, but the pomegranate rockers will also be at the festival.
Well, you don't want to miss that. One of the other things, too, is you're having this sort of recipe contest. What are some of the more creative recipes people have submitted?
You know, we just judged the recipe contest this morning, and there was a pomegranate concentrate style Korean barbecue short rib.
Oh.
That was amazing. There was a pomegranate pork slider with a gorgonzola pomegranate sauce. That was really great. And then, you know, we had cookies, we had cheesecake, we had a number of cocktails. So our judges had an interesting morning. There's a lot of great recipes, a lot of great cooking options with the pomegranate.
Well, I think you just made a lot of people hungry, too, because they all sounded delicious. Now, this is becoming a great tourism tool, isn't it?
Absolutely. So this is us welcoming people into Madera County, celebrating agriculture, and our group, which is the Tourism Alliance of Madera, is actually putting it together, hoping that we'll turn into a multi-day festival. So a multi-day festival, bringing people to Madera County and celebrating agriculture and, of course, the pomegranate.
Now, again, Gib, what is the schedule for the remainder of the week?
There is the pomegranate dinner at the Vineyard on Thursday night. There are certainly seats available for that. You can call the Vineyard restaurant in Madera. I think their phone number is 674-0923. In fact, I'm sure that's what it is, to make reservations. There are pomegranate dinners at Fleming's on Friday night and Saturday night. That's with San Joaquin Wine Company. There is a pomegranate golf tournament on Friday at the Madera Municipal Golf Course, and the softball tournament, which has people coming in from actually all over the state, is Sunday. And then the festival, of course, is Saturday at the airport, free to attend.
Now, is there a cost involved for people to participate, or is it just certain events that will cost?
Well, certainly for the dinners, I mean, there's the cost of the dinner, but at the festival, you can come and experience the whole thing for free. There's no charge to get in. There's no charge for parking. There's no charge for the kids zone. Certainly, and there's lots of food tasting. If you wanted to purchase lunch or purchase a meal, you absolutely will have that opportunity. If you want to take some amazing pomegranates home from Madera, you can purchase those. You can even purchase pomegranate trees at the festival. So there are lots of options if you'd like to take some pomegranate goodness home from Madera County with you, but you can experience everything for free.
Okay, Casey Bahamaring, thanks so much for talking to us about the pomegranate celebration going on this week in Madera County. Sounds great.
Thanks, Juanita.
And before we go and close our program, we'd just like to say that our thoughts and prayers are with the people on the East Coast. As you know and you've been hearing, they have been ravaged by that horrific storm called Sandy. They will be needing a lot of help. And for those of you who feel like you do want to help, I'm sure you can contact your favorite relief agency, Red Cross, Salvation Army, and see how you can help out. Those folks are going to be needing an awful lot of help. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.